Hello and welcome to the Carolina Snowflakes podcast, where two Southerners come to terms with their liberal snowflake tendencies. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Jason.
And we're here with part two of our Black Lives Matter series here on the Carolina Snowflakes podcast, where two white people talk about Black Lives Matter.
That's us.
That's, yeah, we're the white
people. We're the two white people.
Yeah, I feel like that should be kind of set up front.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I, after recently listening to the first episode, I realized that we talk a lot about people who spend their lives dedicated to researching racism and this subject in America and all over the world. And maybe we should talk about who some of those people are and the influences that they had on our lives. A comprehensive list of all of these people would be boring and long, but
no one wants that.
Yeah, but there have been some specific people that have affected us in our lives, and I think we should talk about that. Who would be somebody that affected you in your life?
Well, the one that comes to mind, it actually relates back to part one, in which we talked a little bit about race as a construct. And I think that I take for granted that I know what that means and you know what that means, but maybe not everyone knows completely what a construct is or social construction.
Yeah, I don't think I realized it until I was in my 30s.
Well, I was a little bit younger when I realized it. However, it was something I had to come through via college.
Well, yeah, and girls mature faster than boys.
That's right. So in undergrad, I was in my second semester. I was majoring in sociology.
Okay.
And I was feeling like I didn't quite understand what was being taught to me, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Until my second semester, and I was made to read a book called The Social Construction of Reality.
Okay.
By Berger and Luckman, these two Austrian dudes.
Yeah.
Sociologists, too.
Yeah, okay.
And
sounds very dense.
Yeah, so the book itself is quite small, but what's in it is incredibly dense.
Yeah.
And it's a heavy read, and in fact, I had to read it twice to begin to grasp the concepts.
Wow.
But when I did start to understand and grasp those concepts, it completely changed everything for me. And it all started to make sense of how we come to define and give value to things such as race.
Interesting.
And so this book basically just breaks down step by step how we as a society come to define, label, and assign value to what they call roles.
Yeah, like a system of how people, how social capital works.
How through repeated behaviors become habitual. And over time, those ritual habits actually become institutionalized.
Huh.
Which is also one of the words that you hear used in BLM and racism terms is institutionalized racism.
Right. How does it work its way from just the way you and I behave towards each other into a system that oppresses a whole group of people?
A whole group of people.
I bet there's a lot of steps involved in that.
There's a ton of steps involved, and it's so ingrained.
But like once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's one
of those. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. One of my professors in sociology said, he was like, if you understand sociology, it's like you have a third eye.
Yeah, yeah.
He was like, it opens that third eye, and once you see, you can't unsee.
You can't unsee, yeah.
And it's so true. But like I said, I didn't fully get it until I read this book.
That's fascinating.
I think it would be one for those who want a challenge.
Yeah.
Because it's not an easy read to look into.
Yeah.
The Social Construction of Reality by Berger and Luckman.
That's interesting. It kind of reminds me of recently I've been into this book by Robin DiAngelo called White Fragility. And she has a way of breaking down the social construction of racism that I think is very effective. It helped me think about it. And so I wanted to kind of lay it out here. The idea is that there's three different things that are that go into racism. There is prejudiced.
Yeah.
Then there's discrimination. And then there's racism. And those words are often mixed up together. I think a lot of people mix them together.
Absolutely, yeah.
So for the sake of thinking about it like you and I might, the way we could think about it is prejudiced might be prejudgment that you have of other people. And all human beings are capable of that. You might prejudge somebody, for example, based on if they're old, you open the door for them. That's a prejudgment. You saw they were old, you decided to open the door. That's not even necessarily bad. Prejudice can be good, can be bad. It really depends. discrimination is when you use your prejudgments based about people to hurt them, to bring, to
it's
keep
like
them down.
It's like an action.
Yeah. And that's more what we in our first episode were calling overt racism. Mm-hmm. You can think of in the category of discrimination.
Right.
Yeah. Or not hiring black people.
Right. Yes.
You can put that in the category of discrimination. And then racism is a systematic oppression of a group of people by another group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, black people cannot be racist by this definition.
Right. And I think a lot of times people get that mixed mm-hmm. up, or they don't fully understand that, because you'll hear white people say things like, well, I've been racist against,
yes.
or a black person has been racist against me.
Or I've been in a school where I was the minority, so I know what it's like.
Yeah, you'll hear that.
And
a lot.
Where I think that they're mixing things up is that they're just mistaking discrimination for racism, and they're mistaking mm-hmm. prejudice for racism.
Right.
And black people can totally be discriminatory, and they can totally be prejudiced. In fact, all humans are prejudiced. So
yeah.
The one thing I can say,
honestly, if you want to like break it down to biology, we're probably prejudiced based on survival.
Right. I think it's in our genes.
Yeah, I think it's a survival thing.
I mean, that's an interesting point. Because if you think about our ancestors, you know, when we saw snakes or spiders, we would recoil. Like even now, people are scared of snakes and spiders and scorpions. Mm-hmm. And have you ever realized that you get the same sort of feeling when you see someone who's disfigured, or their body is disfigured in some sort of way?
Yeah, it catches you off guard, kind of takes your breath away. You're like, whoo.
And some people have that feeling a little bit about when they see people who just look different than them.
Right.
And for a long time, for thousands of years, that was a survival mechanism. If somebody was disfigured, it meant they could have a disease that you could catch. And so it behooved you to be afraid of that person.
Right.
Now, we in society have learned to get past that and learn what people have contagious diseases and the ways to prevent them.
Right.
So we no longer have the need to recoil at disfigured people. So we hide it. We tamp it down. We pretend like we don't feel it. Uh-huh. But everyone actually does.
Yeah, to a degree.
And I think racism might be in that same category. It's stamped into our genetics as something that we're supposed to recoil from, people
racism
that look different.
Racism is not.
Right. Well,
prejudice.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Is.
Yeah,
yes.
Correct. Prejudice is in our DNA. It's in our genes.
So the point then is basically that minority groups, people of color, can't technically be racist against
right a white
others,
person because they have
person.
No ability to oppress me,
systematically oppress.
Yeah, no matter what an individual black person thinks about me, they can't get all black people to systematically not hire me and things like
right.
that.
Right. For example, if a black business owner decides not to hire you
mm-hmm.
because you're white,
mm-hmm.
that's not racism.
Yeah.
That's prejudice, that's
exactly.
discrimination, but that's not racism.
Exactly. It was an action, it was a discriminatory action based on prejudice done by a black person.
Right.
To me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think thinking about it in those three separate terms, it really blew my mind. It was really very helpful to me in understanding the construction of race.
And what was the book? Was
it's
that a
called,
book?
Yes, it's a book called White Fragility by a lady named Robin DiAngelo.
Okay.
And it's basically about white fragility, the fact that us as white people have a hard time talking about race.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can attest that in doing this podcast, we have sat here and questioned ourselves.
Oh, for sure.
About what we're doing and whether or not it's even, do I feel like I'm accomplishing anything? Not exactly. Do I feel like it's good? Kind of. Do I feel like I'm not a racist? No. I feel like I'm part of the whole problem and I'm trying to learn how to get better.
Right.
And
at no point do we feel like we are the know-all.
Right. No.
Be-all.
I still have a ton to learn about it. And I would love to hear anything that anybody else wants to send in and say about it. I mean, any recommendations at all. Yeah. Would love to hear from people because I'm eager to learn about this subject. It's something that I hold in high regard.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something that I admit that I don't know nearly enough about. And I wish I knew more.
So who else?
For me, mm-hmm. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a guy who really impacted me a lot. He's a author. He wrote for a bajillion newspapers, Time, The mm-hmm. Atlantic. Mm-hmm. I could go on. And he wrote...
So he's a journalist or a...
Well, he's also a novelist and he's written fiction and nonfiction. So he's a writer.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Two different worlds.
Yeah, he started... Yeah, and he also writes for Marvel Comics. He wrote some of the Black Panther and Captain America series.
Whoa.
Yeah, so he's okay. Kind of prolific in that sense. He's an essayist, a journalist,
a novelist,
and a nonfiction and a book writer,
comic book writer. Wow,
yeah, he also in 2015 he won
kind of a big deal.
Yeah, in 2015 he won the MacArthur Genius Grant. So oh, okay. Yeah, he's a black guy. Obviously, he's from Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book called Between the World and Me, which blew my mind when I first read it. It's his letter to his black son about what he's going to have to experience in the world that he wrote to his son when his son was an infant.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, here's what you're in for. And he also wrote an essay called The Case for Reparations. And he actually testified before Congress about that, arguing for reparations for black people.
Oh.
Yeah. And that was an article. And he had a very famous blog.
Mm-hmm.
He was also on Twitter until 2017, and he kind of got off Twitter. He had a lot of followers, but it was negatively impacting his life. So he gives speeches and he does interviews. There's a ton of things about him on YouTube. You can see it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a way of talking about race that honestly is the easiest digestible I've ever heard. He's so eloquent in his speech, and he simplifies things down into ways that just hit you right in the face.
Mm-hmm.
When he will talk about the Capitol and the White House being built on the sweat and blood of black bodies. And that's something that we don't ever really think about, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And black bodies have been put to use by white people for 200 years to make this country, more than that actually, right, to make this country what it is. And for us to pretend that we can forget about that in a generation is insane.
Well, we pretend to forget about that because, as the first influence you mentioned,
mm-hmm,
we are very fragile.
Yes. Well, that, yeah, we are. We are very fragile. And I like Ta-Nehisi because he doesn't pander to that fragility. He just talks to you about it. And you either take it or you don't.
And he's pretty direct about it.
Oh, yeah.
Just point blank, this is what it is.
And he's an excellent, excellent writer, a very smart guy, and somebody who's also very funny. And I think that plays into my love and why he hit me especially well, because he's a very funny guy. And any interview you ever see with him, he's probably making as many jokes as he has good points. And to me, that's super effective.
It's incredibly effective.
Yeah.
Because I think when you come at people and you're just dropping bombs, mm-hmm, knowledge bombs or facts, mm-hmm, or harsh truths, because we are so fragile.
Exactly.
It isn't always
exactly
well received.
Yeah.
But if you can encapsulate, mm-hmm, it with some humor,
mm-hmm,
us white folk,
yep,
maybe a little more receptive, a little more willing to listen,
yeah,
and hear you out.
And I think that's part of his MO, is his way of communicating that is so effective, and it makes him so interesting to read and to watch. And it really influenced me a lot. I probably discovered him when I was maybe 30,
mm-hmm,
32, and it blew me away. I couldn't believe what I was reading and what I was seeing him say was so to the point, and it was so eloquently worded that I couldn't deny it. I couldn't get it out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a very big influence on me. And he actually gets mentioned by every other person I researched for this podcast. Mm-hmm. Probably 90% of them quoted Ta-Nehisi Coates as somebody who influenced them and somebody who had something to say about this issue. So he's pretty prolific. He might have been an easy call, but he's very important in my life of learning about racism. Do you have another person that may have influenced you?
I do have another, and it actually ties in a little bit with your comment on black bodies,
mm-hmm,
building the White House.
Yes.
And basically our whole country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our economy, for sure.
Yeah. Sonia Renee Taylor.
Okay. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, I think she's been on like NPR. Mm-hmm. She's been on,
I've heard her
MSNBC.
Name for sure.
So she is an author, poet, spoken word artist, humanitarian, social justice advocate, and founder of the Body Is Not an Apology movement.
Oh, wow. So she's got even more titles than Ta-Nehisi does.
She's also kind of a big
deal. Kind of a big deal.
Yeah. I read her book, The, mm-hmm, Body Is Not an Apology, last, mm-hmm, year, and I think she is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's really cool. So she approaches the whole concept of like the body, first of all, as your body is being autonomous.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about how we historically have been obsessed with our bodies.
Oh, yeah.
And we've been obsessed with other people's bodies,
mm-hmm,
going all the way back to slavery when white people owned,
yes,
black bodies.
They literally owned black bodies as property.
Uh-huh. And how that, through time and over time, even post slavery still exists in a sense, that we still feel entitled to comment on, judge, and in ways control bodies.
Yeah, for sure.
And particularly women's bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly Black bodies.
Yeah, and it seems like that's something that people don't want to talk about. It makes people uncomfortable.
Makes people very uncomfortable.
That's why I think we should talk about it.
Yeah, for sure. So this book, The Body Is Not an Apology, she breaks it down as the goal is to learn to love oneself beyond like the standard platitudes and mantras that are out there of like, I am beautiful and gosh darn it, people like me.
Yeah.
She's taking it like one step further in her approach, and she calls it radical self-love, which is essentially the title.
Okay.
Your body should not be something you apologize for.
It should
ever
be.
And I don't know, it's just very empowering, and it's just good. It's just really good.
It seems like it's doing that thing where we tie racial justice in with rights for people's bodies as women, or people's bodies in other ways that might make them put in a category with minorities. Essentially non-white men is what I mean.
Yes. And so radical self-love, back to that, unapologetic, and that when we make peace with our own bodies, we have the capacity to make peace with the bodies of others. And until we can do that, we're going to be hung up on differences.
Well, we're pretty obsessed with our bodies here in America.
We are very obsessed with our bodies, but we're not just our own. It's other people's.
Yeah.
And we feel entitled to judge. We feel entitled to assign value. And we need to stop it.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. It's not helpful.
No.
And it certainly gets in the way of us loving our own selves. Yeah, it seems pretty terrible. I find it very interesting that these things are tied together with racial equality. I've actually learned recently that goes back a lot further than I realized.
What does?
The tie between women's rights and specifically Black people's rights. I actually have another book that influenced me a lot is a book called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by Dr. David Blight. And that in that book, he's going over Frederick Douglass's life, which is a mind-blowing thing in and of itself.
Right.
Guy was a slave for 20 years, gets his freedom, becomes the most famous speaker in the world.
He was adopted by like a white lady, right?
Sort of. Not adopted isn't the word, sold to.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's my white privilege.
Yeah, he was sold to a white lady. Right. She was nice to him, but so she was could really kind. Think of
she,
it as adoption.
She taught him to read.
Yeah, and then he got sent somewhere else. And it's a very long, and his story is very, it's a crazy story. It'll blow your mind. But anyway, he's 20 years a slave. He's now a very famous person. He was the most photographed American of the 19th century, to give you an idea of the level of fame we're talking about.
Also kind of a big deal.
Yeah, as a speaker. And what's interesting is that there was a thing called the Seneca Falls Rally that happened in 1860s. And it was the first big feminist gathering in America where they signed a declaration of what they wanted for women's rights. And at that meeting, there was only a handful of men. There was probably, I think he said, 36 men and 68 women that signed it. And only one Black person that signed it. And that Black person was Frederick Douglass, who really believed in women's rights and women's equality along with the equality of the races. And obviously I knew that they had been tied together in the 60s and that like the idea of women's rights being somehow linked with civil rights for Black folks were tied together, but I didn't realize how old of an idea that was. And I find it very interesting that they're still tied together today. And
you literally hear it said women and minorities.
Right. And I think the reason that they're tied together is because they're both systematically oppressed by the same people, white men.
You guys.
Yeah, it's us.
Your people.
I'm not denying that at all. I think it would be crazy because it's clear that white men are the ones that have an advantage. See, I think that's another thing that white people might be afraid to say. Like, we have an advantage because we're white. It has worked in our favor. And I think a lot of white people don't want to admit that because then that implies that you are only as far as you are because you were just sort of handed it. And the reason you're not further has nothing to do with your abilities or how much you want it. It has to do with...
It's really hard to hear as a white person that your success wasn't... I mean, it was earned, but you had a leg up.
You had a leg up. And that's... There's a difference between saying that you worked hard for your position and saying that if you were black... you would have had to work harder. That's not the same as saying that you didn't work for what you're at. I think people mix that up,
too. Yeah, because you hear people say, well, I worked hard for what I have.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you did. And a lot of white people have worked very hard to get what they have. But had they been black, they would have had to work a lot harder.
Well, had they been black, they probably wouldn't have what they have.
Yeah, and if they did, they would have to be exceptional in the sense...
exceptional or just very lucky. Mm-hmm. They would have had to been one of those people that happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right person to kind of give them that boost that they need.
And I think it's important that we're not afraid to say that it gives us an advantage.
We have to say that. We have to admit that, because if we don't, then we're not going to make anything better.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so. I think it's very important, and I think we need to stop being uncomfortable about admitting that. We need to untie it from this idea that it somehow means you didn't work hard. No one's saying that you didn't work hard. We're saying that if you were black, it would have either been impossible or you would have had to work a lot harder. And that kind of reminds me of something that I read in a book, that one of the ones I mentioned earlier, White Fragility, where she talks about Jackie Robinson and as the baseball player, the first black baseball player in the MLB. And if you think about Jackie Robinson, a lot of times, especially when I was growing up, they always worded, he broke the color barrier. The color barrier in baseball was broken by Jackie Robinson. Just that wording, if you break it down, is racist in itself. Because the implication is that Jackie Robinson was the first black person who was good enough.
And that's not necessarily the case.
No, the case is Jackie Robinson was the first black person that white people let play baseball.
Bingo.
But no one ever wants to word it that way because that makes white people...
uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. But it's the truth.
Yeah.
There were people who were just as good, and I would even argue there were people who may have been better at baseball than Jackie Robinson who were black that were never allowed to even try out.
Because white people didn't let them.
Because white people didn't let them. And that is something that can go institutionalized, because I can tell you that I learned in school that he broke the color barrier. That was the way they worded it to me. And I feel like that's probably something as simple as that can break down white fragility. Something as simple as saying, well, he was the first person white people let. That can make people start to get to shimmering and shaking because you're saying something about whiteness. It's actually interesting that whiteness isn't supposed to be pointed out.
To other white people?
To anybody. Whiteness isn't supposed to be pointed out as a thing, but we don't have too much of a problem pointing out blackness. We'll say that's a black show, that's a black channel, but we don't say this is a white show or a white channel, and that's more into white people being portrayed as the norm, the standard, when you think of human being, you're supposed to think of a white person, and that is just not true. It's not true mathematically, it's not true.
It is true in the sense that we've made it true.
Yes.
Because we have television shows, movies, books, history.
Mm-hmm.
It's all whitewashed.
Yeah, for sure.
It's all white is the norm.
Yeah, I have some statistics about that if you want to hear. So these statistics are from 2016 to 2017, just to be clear. So the 10 richest Americans were all white men.
All men?
Yes.
White men?
All white men.
Hmm.
96% of the governors of states in America were white men. 90% of Congress was white men.
Wow.
100% of the president's military advisors were white men. And this statistic is for all time. 95% of the directors of the top grossing films of all time were white men. And 97% of the owners of NFL teams are white men. To give you an idea of how much of a disparity there is in whiteness and the
ownership
world that we live in.
And
power.
Power, yeah.
And sometimes people hear statistics like this and they want to, you know, react somehow as a company or as a person. And they do little things that are helpful, but they're kind of token things.
Oh, like they try to do something to make it right or apologize or.
Yeah. So for Black History Month, they'll have a commercial that shows a bunch of black people and says, we support
black folks.
And those token things aren't bad in themselves. Mm-hmm. But I think most of the time white people do them to try to absolve themselves of the guilt as opposed to actually helping black people.
Yeah.
And I have a funny story about that, actually. So there's a podcast I listen to called Reply All, and they did an episode where there was a black reporter from England, and he asked on Facebook if anybody had experienced this phenomenon that he'd heard about, where black people are getting Venmo payments from random white people for random amounts of money,
right,
that they hadn't talked to in years, or people they didn't even really know.
So white people
were just Venmoing,
sending cash
to black people.
To black people they know.
Just to kind of feel better about it. Just have a cup of coffee on me.
Yeah.
You know, sorry about racism.
Sorry about that thing that we did that one time.
And when he posted about it on the internet, he got hundreds of replies of people, and they can prove it, that have $7.36 sent to him by a white person that they knew 10 years ago.
That's nuts.
And he interviewed some of them and some of the people that sent the money, and they fess up to it and why, you know, how they thought that,
they're like,
you know,
oh, because I felt bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw George Floyd get murdered in the street and I felt bad. So I went online. I found the last black person that I knew and sent him a cup of coffee. And it's
I'm sorry for 400 years of oppression.
Yeah.
Here's a cup of Joe.
Here, have a cup of Joe on me.
Oh my God.
Yeah, those kind of things aren't necessarily inherently bad by themselves, but you have to examine the reasoning. And if it makes you feel like you're better now, you're not a racist anymore,
it doesn't work like that.
Then you have kind of not passed the test.
Yeah, I mean, I think historically we as a country have tried many routes of tokenism.
I know.
To appease and say we're sorry, and they're not always successful.
No, I mean, you can think about even something that we all kind of sort of agree on, Black History Month. You can think of that as a thing where we're still othering black people, because so during the rest of the year, most of the things that you read in school are, you know, Ernest Hemingway, J.D. Salinger, Charles Dickens, William Shakespeare. They're all white men, but they're supposedly writing about the universal human experience.
But are they really?
But are they?
Yeah.
And then what you have is a month where you're reading quote unquote black authors. And so somebody like Toni Morrison can't be an author. She can only be a black author.
Right.
And but
Black History Month.
Yeah, but Charles Dickens isn't a white writer. We would never say that.
No, we just say it's Charles Dickens.
Yeah, but Toni Morrison is stuck being a black writer, and I don't think that we've examined that enough. I think that's very important, because that's how I was brought up, and it was how I was inculcated with racism, and I think it's how a lot of people are.
One of the more recent tokens is the removal of the Confederate flag by NASCAR.
Oh, yeah,
Or the banning of the Confederate flag by NASCAR.
It's all good now.
Yeah, so cool.
Yeah.
Racism doesn't exist
There's
anymore.
There's still only one black driver in all of NASCAR.
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of a token thing there.
It's
definitely a
token.
It's not a bad thing. It's
No. We're not knocking it, saying it's bad. We're just saying, like, that's not really fixing the problem
No, it's really not.
And I know for me, as a kid, one of the token moves was for, like, Mattel and the toy makers to start making, like, black Barbie dolls and black baby dolls and stuff. And I had a black baby doll.
Did you?
When I was little, yeah. And so I remember her hair turned pink in water, in, like, warm water.
Mm-hmm.
So she was, like, my bath time black baby doll.
That's like, I don't know if what that's supposed to be
either. But I guess it was like, you know, it was the 80s.
Yeah.
So, like, my mom, I guess, was like, we're going to be progressive.
Yeah.
Here's a black baby doll. she bought into that tokenism of, like, let's teach our kids to.
Well, here's an interesting one you might not have thought of dealing with plastic. So, medical models that we use in doctor's offices and models for medical students to use. Have you noticed they're always white?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I never thought about that. Yeah, you're right. Anytime you go, because I'm one of those people that likes to sit in the doctor's office and play with the models.
They're always white.
They are always white.
Yeah, because white's normal.
I've not ever thought of that.
Yeah. No one really does. And when it's pointed out to you, it might shake you up a little bit.
Yeah, a bit.
Yeah.
But then I kind of wonder, I also kind of wonder though, like what the response would be if the medical model was black.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know.
How would white patients respond to that?
I don't know. A lot of people tend to think that young people are better and that we're somehow getting rid of racism. And I would like to point out a study that maybe goes against that.
Oh.
That idea. So they did a study. This was 2 years ago where they gave preschoolers. They took a bunch of preschoolers and gave them a set amount of money and said that you have to divvy it up amongst the class. And in one group, they had a white person in there with them, a white adult in the room with them while they divvied up the money. And in another room, they didn't. And what they found was the white kids took more money than the black kids either way. Mm-hmm. But in the room with the white person in it, they took significantly less.
Who was in charge of divvying up
the preschoolers?
White preschoolers, yes. Or black preschoolers?
White preschoolers.
Oh, okay.
We're given, this is the amount of money for your class. You have to divide it up amongst your classmates.
Oh, okay.
And what they found was that the white people would take more of the money when they were alone. And then when there was a white adult in the room, they would still take more money from the black people, but they would be significantly less. So these are preschoolers. These are kids who were in preschool, and they've already learned to have white solidarity and to hide it.
Uh-huh.
Especially around a white authority figure. And so this hope that maybe there's this future generation that's not going to be racist is, that's not true unless we do stuff.
Well, that goes back to my very first mm-hmm. influence. And,
yes.
And the social constructionism. Mm-hmm. It is so deep. It is intrinsically mm-hmm. woven into the fabric of our society.
Yeah.
And we cannot unwove it.
Right.
Unless we get in there mm-hmm. and pull it apart.
And we're all going to have to work together.
It's not just going to go away.
Right. We're all going to have to work together. And the first thing you need to do as a white person is learn. I don't know what the next step is. I'm still learning.
Yeah, we're still in it.
Yeah. I think of it like a loop, or an infinity symbol. It's a continuum. I'm moving forward on learning. I will probably die before I've learned as much as I would like to about it. But I'm going to do my best, my damnedest, to keep learning.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we're doing this.
Yeah. In fact, this has been a really good boost for me because it's helping me put into words the things that I'm learning that are floating around into my brain.
And to put them into words in which we can share with others mm-hmm. and with other white folks
mm-hmm.
in a way that's white speak to other white speak.
Yes.
Like, guys, this is worth knowing and exactly. this is worth learning about. And we have the power and the capacity to affect change.
We do. And you can do it by educating yourself.
Yes.
Because you can't change what you don't know. You can't change what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that does it for part two of our Black Lives Matter series here on uh-huh. the Carolina Snowflakes podcast. If you like what you heard, we would love to hear back from you. You can find us on Facebook at
facebook.com/Carolina Snowflakes.
We have a website at
carolinasnowflakes.com.
And you can also email us at
carolinasnowflakes@gmail.com.
Gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. Bye.